They made me a machine gunner, 30 caliber light machine gunner. And what they didn't tell me, that some of my colleagues told me in the Army, said, you know, the life expectancy of a 30 caliber light machine gunner is 3 days. And I spent 201 days on the front line. I'm still here.
In June of 1943, a young man named Arnold Gabriel walked into a military induction center, having graduated from high school just a week earlier. A talented flutist, he had been offered a position with the United States Navy Band, and he had the letter in his hand to prove it. But that dream of being a military musician came crashing down when he was told upon enlistment that his letter was useless, and that instead of becoming a Navy bandsman, he would be sent to the Army to be trained as a combat machine gunner. What followed was a remarkable 37-year military career that took Gabriel from the beaches at Normandy to an officer commission in the U.S. Air Force to eventually reaching the pinnacle of the career he had originally dreamed of pursuing. From the United States Air Force Band, this is the Connection Series, a podcast that examines the intersections of the military, music, and storytelling. I am your host, Master Sergeant Brooke Emery, and today, in honor of the 75th anniversary of D-Day, we explore the extraordinary life of Colonel Arnold D. Gabriel. Before we begin today, just a little bit of background on D-Day. So although D-Day is used as military language for the day an operation or event will take place, it is most often associated with the date of June 6, 1944, which is the day the Allied powers crossed the English Channel and landed on the beaches of Normandy, France. Their ultimate victory was the beginning of the liberation of Western Europe from Nazi control during World War II, and a crucial turning point in the war. 16 million Americans served in World War II, and of those, about 73,000 fought on that fateful day. 2019 estimations have the number of living American World War II veterans between 350 and 400,000, and although no official count has been kept of the living number of American veterans who stormed the beaches at Normandy on D-Day, statistics suggest they number somewhere around 5,000. Most adult Americans today grew up with a family member who served in the war, and the accounts of those vets have a very personal connection to the generations after them. But that is all changing rapidly. Estimations are that by 2036, there will be no living World War II veterans. At 94, Colonel Gabriel is an increasingly rare living connection to that part of our American history. But that's just one of the reasons his story is so special. Here to discuss this is the current commander of the United States Air Force Band, Colonel Don Schofield. Welcome, Colonel Schofield.
Thanks so much.
Colonel Gabriel served as the commander of the United States Air Force Band from 1964 to 1985. Can you tell me a little bit about the impact he had on the Air Force Band and the way military music programs were viewed and utilized?
I think Colonel Gabriel has a wide-ranging legacy with our organization and the Air Force itself. First of all, he comes from a different breed. He's a combat veteran, combat infantryman that was on the beaches that day. Among the ranks of Air Force Band officers, he's the only one that has that. So he has a unique capability and a perspective on leadership and followership. When he assumed control of the United States Air Force Band, he brought it to national and international significance. He instituted a guest artist policy in which he brought the biggest names in the world to perform alongside the United States Air Force Band with performances that were live and broadcast. And it did provide that access and placement that we're looking for. So he was visionary in that. Colonel Gabriel was also very involved in music education, and many people our age have first heard of the Air Force Bands through his guest conducting. I know I was in an all-state band in the 1980s, and he was the conductor, and that was my first experience with an Air Force Band member, or really anybody in the Air Force. So he has become an international ambassador for the Air Force.
And it's true. I think that that experience you had in that all-state band is not a unique one. There are students all over the country that had that experience with them, and it was a seminal moment in their formative musical journey. Now, I have been a member of the band for 16 years, and one thing that continually surprises me is the sheer amount of reverence and personal connection people feel with Colonel Gabriel. It just cannot be underestimated. Why do you think that is?
One word, expectation, that he exudes a very high level of expectation from those that are around him. As those who have played under him know, Colonel Gabriel rehearses and performs from memory. He memorizes not only the music, but all the individual parts, and he knows what people need to be playing at what time. If there's some discrepancy with that, he's able to point it out very quickly. I asked him one time about that, about why he memorizes the music, and he said it was very simple. You want your head in the music and not your head in the score, and I thought that was a great analogy for being able to be engaged with the players. And I think that's the real secret for the reverence that people have. He's engaging. He has an incredible story. He is he's very personable, and he has a very high expectation of himself and you as a musician that's playing with him. In fact, just last week, he and I were having a conversation about Europe. He served as the commander of the United States Air Forces in Europe Band, and so did I. And we were comparing our experiences. And it was just a real joy to hear what he has done and set forth, you know, 50 years ago before I was there in Europe commanding, and just such an appreciation that I have for that.
We're releasing this podcast in conjunction with a video product that features Colonel Gabriel conducting the United States Air Force Symphony Orchestra on a piece that is very special to him. It's John Williams's Hymn to the Fallen from the motion picture Saving Private Ryan. Can you tell me a little bit about that project?
Sure. The movie Saving Private Ryan is built around World War II, and actually that day, June 6, 1944. It's very stirring. It's patriotic. It's very reverent music. And this has been something that is very close to what the experience that Colonel Gabriel has had in that. He was just a boy. He was asked to grow up instantly on that beach. And I think if you were to ask Colonel Gabriel, he doesn't talk about it much. But in his book, he detailed the fact that he lost many, many friends on that campaign during Operation Overlord. And I think to him, it is much more than a piece of a movie soundtrack. It is what the movie stands for in terms of brotherhood and camaraderie, and the ones that he lost along the way. So it's a special piece for him. And us being able to do that with Colonel Gabriel, again, conducting from memory, 94 years old, being very, very sharp with what he's doing, and having a commanding presence on the podium, it's absolutely thrilling for us to look and see a glimpse back in time for what he stood for. And you can see the glint in his eye, the same glint that he had when he stood on the beaches there in France.
Colonel Schofield, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We are going to transition now to Colonel Gabriel telling his own story. This audio is excerpted from a 2006 interview he gave with Dr. Tim Lotzenheiser at the Midwest Band and Orchestra Clinic in Chicago. He discusses his childhood in Cortland, New York, his experiences in World War II, and his career as an Air Force officer.
My childhood, I guess, is the classic example of the poor child of Italian immigrants. My mom and dad were born in Italy and came to this country separately, met in Brooklyn, New York, and it was a rough go during that Depression period. And I can remember very clearly having a can of beans for dinner for my brother and me and my parents. So things were really tough. But we didn't know because everybody was poor in those days. But it was an Italian ghetto whereby everybody in the neighborhood spoke Italian. I learned to speak Italian before I spoke English. And when I went to kindergarten, I couldn't speak English.
Really?
I still have trouble. But anyway, my first experience with music, my dad loved music. And every Saturday afternoon, he had the Metropolitan Opera on and sang along with all of the arias. And it's crackly old voice, and he wanted me to be another Enrico Caruso. And of course, I have the world's worst voice. So he took me to the basement of the Catholic Church right across the street from where we lived, and it was a touring company from Syracuse. When they did the intermezzo from Cavalieri's Toccata, that was the opera, I just melted, and to this day, it's my favorite 48 measures of music. And I told my dad about it. I said, I just love that. So the American Legion had a fife and drum corps, the Sons of the American Legion. So I played fife when I was 9 and 10 years old. It was the year after I'd heard the opera. And then when I went to junior high, it was natural that I would play flute from fife. So I played both in the band and orchestra in junior high. It was a junior-senior high kind of a thing. And then in 1939, my freshman year, Burton E. Stanley came to conduct the Cortland High School band, and he really changed my life. He was one of those dedicated people who treated everybody. He knew we were dirt poor, and I took private lessons from him and never charged me a nickel. He was that kind of a guy. When I was a senior in 1942, my brother was working in Washington, D.C. at the government printing office. And I had heard the United States Navy Band on tour, and I wanted to play in the Navy Band. December of 42, I took the train to Washington, D.C., and stayed with my brother, took the streetcar over to the Navy Yard, and auditioned for the staff there. And they gave me a letter, which meant that I was a bypass specialist. In those days, when you went to the induction center, you could pick your branch of service, Army, Navy, Marines, or Air Force. So, or Army Air Corps it was in those days. So in June of 43, when I enlisted after high school, I enlisted on June 28, 6 days later, I enlisted. And I went to the induction center. Here's my letter from the United States Navy Band. Too bad, it doesn't count. Everybody's going to the Army. Oh my gosh. Trained with the 78th Division in Virginia. It was the Lightning Division. I was a BAR man, a Browning automatic rifle. And they made me a machine gunner, 30 caliber light machine gunner. And what they didn't tell me, that some of my colleagues told me in the Army, said, you know, the life expectancy of a 30 caliber light machine gunner is 3 days. And I spent 201 days on the front line. I'm still here. But you know, it's interesting. People say, you know, Gabe, we understand that you hit the beach of Normandy on D-Day, which I did with the 116th Regiment, the 29th Division. But, you know, that was one day out of 201, and there were so many other battles that I remember so clearly, some of those battles that were never written about, but in my division history, there was the Battle of Boerheim that started on November 1644, little town of about 200 people, and we fought back and forth with the Germans for about 5 days, and it wasn't house to house, it was room to room, and the carnage and the bloodshed that I saw was unspeakable. There were dead Americans and dead Germans in the same room. You couldn't get them out because there were counterattacks every single day. I saw Americans being held captive and being machine gunned. January 9th is the saddest day of my life because there were three of us from my machine gun squad that were hit with a mortar shell. Both of them were killed, and I just had a concussion. So that's the saddest day of my life. You know, when you're in the infantry, it's a totally different kind of environment. I mean, you don't even speak English anymore, you know. Everything is just so overwhelming with bloodshed and destruction. And you live with that, and you come back, and you're just withdrawn from society. I mention all of this because it does have a context. I just want you to know the mindset that I was in when I retired from the Army. I was really antisocial. I was in the Army of Occupation, and because of all of this trauma, I ate too much and I drank too much. I was Sergeant of the Guard, so so I could go anywhere I wanted with my Jeep, and my roommate was a mess sergeant. So we would ram all night long, get back to the base about 1 o'clock in the morning and have a gallon of coffee, a loaf of toast, and a dozen eggs. And I ballooned to 225 pounds.
Whoa. How much?
220 pounds. So Lieutenant Newt D. Butler, who I admired, came to me, and this is a wonderful example of mentorship. He came to me and he said, "Sergeant, what's wrong with you?" And I said, "What do you mean, what's wrong?" He said, "You're eating too much and you're drinking too much. You're wasting yourself." And I said, "Well, you remember on D-Day such and such happened? You remember in Normandy this happened?" And he said, "Sergeant, it's okay to look back, just don't stare." What a wonderful example.
Absolutely.
The 29th Division was going to come back early because they were overseas long before I was. So they had new equipment, new flags, new rifles, new uniforms, everything. Now, our company guide on 175th Regiment Company I had been through battle and had been hit by all kinds of shells and had been sewn very crudely. So when the division came back, he called me to the office and said, "Sergeant, we want you to have, since you're the only survivor." So he gave me the regimental flag. That's probably my most treasured possession. And when I came back to the United States, I worked in a factory for 87 cents a day in the warehouse because there was nobody there. I didn't want to socialize with anybody. So Burton E. Stanley came. He said, "No, you're going to college." I said, no. I said, "I haven't played an instrument in 3 years, and I can't compete with people coming right out of high school, people who played military bands. The only thing I've played is a machine gun for 3 years." And he said, "You're going to college." This was August of 45. So without my knowing it, he went to Ithaca College. He was a graduate of Ithaca and paid my matriculation fee, waived my audition, talked to both the band and orchestra conductor and said, "This guy probably has talent. Put him in the first chair."
So how many years were spent at Ithaca?
4.5 initially. And I think everybody should do this. We should be like sponges. And I was. I was eager to learn because I knew nothing, you know. I hadn't played for 3 years. I worked my fingers to the bone. I worked practice probably 5 or 6 hours a day.
Playing your flute.
So that I would not disappoint Stanley. Yeah. You know, I made it a point to that, okay, I'm going to be a band director. And to be a band director, I have to understand all of the instruments. So I made it a point when I was in college, we had three bands in those days. In the second, third band, I played every instrument in the band. And then some people come to me and say, "Well, where do you get experience conducting?" Well, in my sophomore year, there was a band in Homer, New York. There was a church choir looking for a director. I said, "I conduct church choirs." I had no idea I conducted church choirs. And a drum and bugle corps. But it was this is my sophomore year. I did that for 3 years in my undergraduate. And that experience was invaluable. And I was getting paid, too. I paid my $6 a week rent. $6 a week, including breakfast, by the way. So that's the way I got my conducting experience. You have to make your own opportunities. Nobody's going to come to you and say, "Would you like to conduct this band?"
Okay, so we're finished with college now, and there's the door opens, and what happens next, Colonel?
Oh, my gosh. it was Korea.
Yeah.
And having served 201 days on the front line, I'm not going to go back to the Army. And I had heard about the United States Air Force band program expanding, and I went to Washington, took the audition, and the idea was I was going to become a band director for the duration of the Korean War. I recruited anybody going through there that could play an instrument. So we had terrific players, guys who played with Spivak. And I saw this one young guy who played a little bit of clarinet. Didn't play very well, but he was a producer in New York City. And it turns out, I said, "How many connections do you have in New York City?" Well, it turned out we did a 30-minute broadcast on the Mutual Network over 512 stations for an entire year, and he produced all of those shows.
So from there to Langley.
Yeah, at Langley, I was going to get out of the service because the Korean War was over,
yeah.
And my mom and dad were living in Miami, And I was going to teach school. And there was a Colonel Ben LaBailey. I told him that I was going to put in my papers and retire from the Air Force because the war was over. He said, "You're going to do what?" I said, "I'm not going to go teach school." And this guy, if you cut his arm, he would bleed blue. I mean, that's how much he loved the United States Air Force. He said, "God damn it, Gabe. We want the best cooks and bakers and truck drivers and pilots and band directors. We want you to stay in the..." Okay, yes, sir. So I reenlisted. And then when I went from Langley to Germany, we had five bands in Europe, and I was command band director of all five of those bands. Now, you know, that's not so far after World War II, and I'm wearing the combat infantryman's badge trying to play for Germans. It was a little tense, but I got over that. And the impact of American music in Europe was terrific. We were asked to play a music festival in Mönchengladbach. There were going to be five bands, four European bands and an American band. I said, Mönchengladbach reminded me, and I kind of left this out in World War II. We crossed the Ruhr River on February 1645 and fought for 4 or 5 days, house to house in Jülich. And our commanding general said, right up the road about 20 kilometers is Mönchengladbach, 250,000 people. Now, if we take that city, we'll make headlines, you know, biggest American or German city taken in the war to that date. So we marched all night long and attacked the next day and took Mönchengladbach after about 5 or 6 days. Now, turn the calendar forward 15 years, and I've got to do a music festival in Mönchengladbach. And I combined three of our bands, a band from England, the one from Rammstein, and my Wiesbaden band, into about an 80-piece marching band. And we played Glenn Miller and Irving Berlin and Gershwin. And the people went absolutely bananas. We finished the show. And after the festival was over, the mayor said he'd like to invite all of the bands to the Ratskeller, which was the basement of the town hall. Huge place. So we're all sitting there having dinner, and I'm sitting with my band, and the mayor and his assistants came up, and he had something under his coat, kind of sheepishly looking around. He said, "Now, Captain, this was not a competition, but we all felt that the American band was best. We want to give you the city flag of Mönchengladbach." It was the headline of the Star and the Stripes. Gabriel captures Mönchengladbach in war and with music.
How did you change the landscape of the United States Air Force Band?
Well, several things. When I entered the Air Force in 51, I heard the Army Band do the world premiere of the Hindemith Symphony. And I thought, you know, this is neat, a band doing contemporary works. So I kind of developed a commissioning program. And we have many, many fine composers write for concert bands. So we started that program. The bands were not able to make recordings in that day. They made one in 63 for the dedication of the Kennedy Center, RCA Records. But I went to the GCA, Government Services Administration, and found out we could make records. So I started that project, not only with the concert band, the singing sergeants, the airmen, who all made recordings, and now all the service bands are. And of course, we send them to educators, and I hope you put them to good use.
What did you do in terms of reaching audiences that was different?
Well, we started the guest artist series, and that started in 1966. Lyndon Johnson was president, and Mrs. Johnson had a program called Keep America Beautiful. You all remember that? Nobody remembers 66.
Yeah. Yeah.
Plant a bush or a tree. So she said, you know, to call attention to this program, we'd like to have the Air Force Band. I don't know why she picked on us. Do a concert and kick off this program, Keep America Beautiful. And Lyndon Johnson's favorite movie actor was Gregory Peck. He couldn't get him because he was doing a picture. So his second choice was Edward G. Robinson. So the White House called Edward G. Robinson, and he came and did a concert with us, with the Air Force Band. And I thought, and of course we filled the auditorium
sure.
because of his stature. But he so loved the band that he came back, I think, I don't know, probably 10 or 12 times.
You became one of your best friends, right?
Oh, yes. But I met Ira Gershwin through Edward G. Robinson. And he introduced me to several of his other friends, and that started the guest artist series.
And there's a lineage of those people.
But I had 153 altogether.
Can you just give us a real quick snapshot of the Shirley Temple story?
Shirley Temple so loved the Air Force Band that when she co-hosted the Mike Douglas Show, which emanated from Philadelphia, and she did it, I think, four or five times, she always asked for the Air Force Band to appear. And she did some dramatic readings with us. I Am an American of Carmen Dragon. So we became very, very good friends and had dinner with her in Woodside. And when she was ambassador both to Ghana and Czechoslovakia, then Czechoslovakia, she'd come back to the State Department about twice a year, always picked up the phone, Gabe, come on over for lunch. She was that kind of a person, just a wonderful person. But I think the story you're talking about, is she'd had a radical mastectomy, and she was very, very depressed. We were doing a concert in San Francisco on tour, and I called her on the phone, and she didn't answer. Her daughter, Susan, answered the phone. And I said, Susan, I'd like to invite your mom to come to our concert in San Francisco. And she said, Colonel, she has not had a guest in 6 months. She's very, very depressed. I said, well, why don't we bring the concert to her? And she said, what do you mean? I said, I ride the bus with the singing sergeants. We'll just run, and we'll run the bus up the hill. We'll stop about halfway so she doesn't hear the bus, and we'll walk the rest of the way. And then she said, Mom, it's time that you had some guests, and there are some people who want to come and see you. She said, well, maybe it's time. So she got all dolled up, and of course, she was still in a wheelchair. And we were across the swimming pool, and right across the swimming pool were the French doors to her bedroom. So Susan wheeled her out, and the singing sergeants broke out to Pretty Girl Is Like a Melody.
Can't escape. She's in your memory. By morning, night, and noon.
And following that, I had a call from her daughter, Aunt Susan, who said, thank you, Colonel, for coming to serenade my mom, but also to bring her out of her depression. And from that day forward, she was seeing people, and she felt good about life again.
Can you give us some highlights from your heart about things that happened with the Air Force Band? We've listened to the recordings, things that you did that brought the globe together.
These are four of the highlights that I remember, and there's a theme here, if you'll all pay attention. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir, obviously, as a highlight, of course, Mormon. And we did a concert for Pope John at Vatican with 70,000 people. I had a picture taken with him. I'll go back to that in a minute. Of course, that's Catholic. And did the Tokyo Kasai, which is Buddhist. And every year when I was in Europe, we played for the Shah of Iran, which was the center of Islam. So when I go to heaven, I've touched all bases.
Any of the military bands wouldn't be what they are today had it not been for that bridge that you built at that time. You shifted the whole blueprint of military bands
right.
In a very positive
commissioning
way.
Programs and
yes.
Recordings and all of that sort of outreach thing that I thought was very, and all of the bands do it, and I'm very proud that they are. And I hired the first woman too in 1973 to change the complexion of the entire military band program because the next year, obviously, we hired women for our singing sergeants, and that opened up a whole bunch of opportunities with the repertoire we could do, Sound of Music and so forth, anything SATB.
And how many years in front of that United States Air Force Band of Washington, D.C.?
21 years with them.
Which is longer than anybody stood
That's
on
right.
that podium.
Yeah.
Going to hang up the baton?
Oh, gosh. No, I was conducting the McLean Symphony Orchestra. I did that for 17 years, and of course did the George Mason Orchestra for 10 years. And even though I've had five surgeries in the last year and a half, the Midwest is my 25th engagement this year. Nothing stops me.
Can you tell us about the Wheaton Municipal Band and the contract they have on you for?
Oh, yeah. About 5 or 6 years ago, I go back about every 2 or 3 years. This past year, we had Alan Mazzuti and John Hagstrom from the Chicago Symphony. About 4 or 5 years, Bruce said, you know, Colonel, you look like you could do a concert when you're 100. And I said, I'm going to. Well, I got back to Washington, D.C., and he sent me a contract. And I slept in.
Great.
I signed it and sent it back.
Absolutely. Let me share one last statement, and then I'll let you put the capper on this. But this was written by a very good friend of yours, by the way, a trumpet player, an up-and-comer called Doc Severinsen. And this is what Doc Severinsen wrote in Colonel's retirement program. He said, in the years that I've worked with and for Colonel Arnold Gabriel, I have unsuccessfully sought words to convey my impression of this man. Besides being one of the finest musicians in the world today, he brings to the world of music the qualities of integrity and courage that we usually associate with a battlefield hero, which he is. I feel that these qualities add a character to his music that gives it a dimension found only once in a great while on this earth. Colonel, for so many of us, you are our hero, and we know that you're just starting this career. And we want you to get that 100th year check when you go to Bruce Moss's. Would you like to share any last words as we conclude this incredible time together?
Well, the most important thing in my life is people.
Yes, sir.
And I just love people. I love all of you and what you do. Just continue to do it.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please help me thank Colonel Arnold D. Gabriel.
To hear the full interview between Colonel Gabriel and Tim Lotzenheiser, you can visit our website at www.usafband.af.mil. Or you can go to our YouTube channel, just search The USAF Band, where you can not only listen to the entire interview, you can watch Colonel Gabriel conduct the United States Air Force Symphony Orchestra at the age of 94. The Connection series is a United States Air Force Band production. This episode was produced by myself along with Senior Master Sergeant Matthew Irish. Recording and editing help were provided by Senior Master Sergeant Dennis Hoffman and Master Sergeants Emily Wellington, Mike Hampf, and Jim Devon. The executive producer of the United States Air Force Band's Connection series is Colonel Don Schofield.